This is Father Gregory Pine, and welcome back to the Thomistic Institute podcast for another installment of Off-Campus Conversations, during which we chase down a Thomistic Institute speaker, lay hold of him by main force, and say, talk to us more. No, it's generally more serene than that. So this episode, I am delighted to be joined by Dr. R.J. Snow. Thanks for joining.
Oh, so good to be with you. Thank you, Father Gregory.
So folks might know you from several books that you've published on a variety of topics. Your work, obviously, with the Witherspoon Institute, and maybe some talks that you've given also on campuses, which have been broadcast the world over through the Thomistic Institute podcast. Keep going, Father Gregory. But for those who don't know you, would you say a word of introduction?
Yeah, sure. I'm R.J. Snell. I'm a philosopher by training. Catholic convert about 12 years ago, grew up Baptist, entered the church about 12 years ago. I'm the director of academic programs at the Witherspoon Institute in Princeton, New Jersey, and the editor-in-chief of Public Discourse, which is our online journal. My most recent book is Lost in the Chaos, Imminence, Despair, and Hope. That just came out in December. And book before that with Robbie George on intellectuals who've converted to the church. And before that, a book on sloth.
So. Nice.
Yeah.
Cool.
Good to be with you. And I've done happily done talks for TI over the years.
And we're grateful. And we're showing our gratitude by asking you to do more.
Exactly.
Infinite consumption. No, we want to push back a little bit against a culture of infinite consumption and just talk a little bit about play. So you've spoken at these campuses from time to time on like leisure or the soul of leisure or on this idea that we as human beings are perhaps best expressed or best realized in things like meals and dances than in Taylor time and motion studies. So I thought that we could just talk a little bit about play, maybe kind of on a personal note, what interests you in these types of questions? Was it like you came across Joseph Pieper's Leisure, the Basis of Culture, and it made your socks go up and down, or you were burnt out and looking for ways to reclaim something of your humanity? Like, kind of what led to an interest in these themes?
Yeah, you know, Joseph Pieper plays an outsized role in these sorts of reflections, of course. You know, years ago, I'd been assigned Leisure, the Basis of Culture by Peter Kraft at Boston College. And I was fine with the book. I thought it was interesting, but I actually wasn't that moved by it. But one of the things that I've tried to do in my writing career, such as it is I'm trying to write generally for my students. Like the concerns that I think they have, the questions that they're asking me, I'm not a scholar. I'm trying to answer questions that have been posed to me or that I think are in the air. And the idea of total work that Pieper talks about in Leisure, the Basis of Culture, seemed to me to be more and more obvious that the students that I deal with, and I deal with students from a variety of campuses, large, small, private, public, and so on, that wherever they were, they felt just an insatiable need to produce. And conspicuous busyness was a sign of virtue. Right? So you ask someone in contemporary America, how are you? And they will invariably say, so busy. And they may or may not be busy, but the idea that they have nothing to do or they took the day off is sort of shameful. Right, like no one will ever admit that they have too much money or that they've been asleep when you wake them. They always say, I was awake. No one will admit that they've taken leisure or taken a break. They're busy. A couple of years ago, Mark Schiffman had a great essay. He was at Villanova at the time, in First Things called Majoring in Fear, which I really resonated with the essay. And his argument was the current student wasn't majoring in physics or in philosophy. They were majoring in fear. And some of this was because, you know, the job market's tight, student loans are high, these sorts of things, but that they had been taught by the adults to be in an endless competition. And so they were racking up majors and minors and credentials and internships, but they didn't know why. And he made a claim, which I've always really resonated with since I read it the first time, which is that the novel of the generation is Hunger Games, where the adults have trained the young to be ready for life and death competitions, but no one knows why, and there's no good to the competition per se. And so obviously the kids are racked by anxiety. You know, at Princeton, the Daily Prince, the newspaper, every day there's a story about anxiety. And university services across the country will tell you that one of the main problems they face in dealing with students is overwork, burnout, and just anxiety as the mode of the day. You know, I haven't seen the movie, but there's a new Inside Out 2, which is a, you know, a cartoon about the inner life of a child. Inside Out 1, she was very young. Now she's a teenager, I guess. When she was young, I think it was anger, which was the dominant emotion. And now that she's 13 or 14 or whatever, it's anxiety. Well, that seems strange to me. When I was 14, anxiety was not the governing emotion of my life. But it seems to be the governing emotion of the day for a student. So Pieper, yeah, although to be honest, I like his In Tune with the World, A Theory of Festivity, a lot more than I like Leisure, the Basis of Culture.
Cool. Dude, that's a hot take. Respect. So note it, listener.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's sweet. Okay. I had read Leisure the Basis of Culture in a freshman class at Franciscan University of Steubenville, and then in a book club at St. Louis Bertrand. And there was, you know, there were things from it that I found applicable or found pertinent, or I tried to appropriate in my own life, but it didn't have for me the kind of effect that some described it having in their own lives. And in part, I suppose that's because I don't yet fully sympathize with the call to leisure on an existential level. And in part because of the crazy busy reasons that you mentioned, it's like I'm just kind of buffering myself against the recognition that there might be a real void at the heart of many of my pursuits. And I'm just telling people that I'm busy so that way I don't have to confront the kind of vacuousness of a lot of things. Nevertheless, we just, you know, progress along the way. So I think that maybe just to kind of ask a follow-up question, I suspect that many in this generation of college-going students, let's just say Gen Z, are somewhat critical of earlier generations, if not in the same generational terms as are deployed by their seniors. I think millennials are very generation conscious. I think Gen Z types are less generation conscious. Like, they're like, what are you guys? You're all like tuned up about what happens every 15 years. But it seems like Gen Z has found its way by which to push back or to self-medicate or to anesthetize. You know, so we talk about use of technology as a way by which to pacify, but we also see like quiet quitting. You know, a lot of folks in Gen Z are going to work as much as they work. And if they get fired, they don't really care because they're not committed to the same corporate aims as earlier generations may have been. Is there something there that gestures towards a reclaiming of a culture of leisure and festivity, or is it kind of a fizzling out or a kind of descent into that vacuous, whatever state you would call that I just described?
Yeah, I don't myself think that by and large, it's a course correction from an excess back to the mean so much as an exhaustion with the excess.
Mm.
So you take quiet quitting, for example, or the sort of endless doom scrolling through TikTok or what have you. That's not a recovery of leisure or a recovery of contemplation. It's a rejection of overwork. It's a rejection of the sense that, you know, large corporate America is going to take care of you. And if you really lean in, you can have everything. And I think some of it is a kind of, for some, a kind of sense that it doesn't matter how hard you work, you're never going to pay off your student loans. You're never going to be able to be married. You're never going to afford a house, you know, those sorts of things. So why not have a little more rest, a little more self-care, some hobbies and habits which you enjoy. But I don't think it's a recovery in the sense of being tuned back to, this is Pieper from In Tune with the World, existential richness. I think it's just another kind in the main of existential poverty. It's not so much of an embrace of the good, so much as a rejection of a distortion.
Yeah.
That's my sense.
Okay.
Of it.
Well, yeah, that sounds right. I'm thinking now of like what it would mean for this for me. Let's just speak in personal terms. What would it mean for me to reclaim a kind of leisurely approach to life? You know, there are certain things about my religious profession which make it kind of mandatory, which I'm grateful for because
yeah, right.
It saves me from myself.
Yeah.
But then I think that like sometimes people hear leisure described and it sounds like an affectation. It's like, what do you want me to like pick up the lute? You know, no one's been playing the lute since the 18th century.
Yeah, that's right.
Or you just recognize at the outset that it's like, you know, those those systems that we studied in ninth grade biology, where you have to have a little bit of input energy in order for the chemical reaction to like release what is in fact something that feels good, you know? So it's like it requires of us, or it places a claim on us. So we actually have to commit to a thing. Like, we've all been through the first stages of learning an instrument. Not only do we punish all those in our immediate vicinity, we kind of punish ourselves because we haven't yet gotten to the point in which the actual exercise is enjoyable. It's just kind of, it just stinks. So maybe, I don't know. There are a variety of objections, the affectation objection, the input energy objection, but like, what stands in the way of our reclaiming a kind of leisurely approach to life?
It's funny you mentioned the lute. At some TI talk, I don't remember which one, I used the example of the hammered dulcimer. Like, leisure is not, you sort of play around with a hammered dulcimer. And a friend of mine called me up quite angry after he heard the TI, the podcast, because he plays the hammered dulcimer. Tremendous. So I was like, it's just an example. It wasn't directed at you, my friend. I didn't even know you played the hammer dulcimer.
No, you should have doubled down and been like, it was a personal attack. I was actually banking on you listening to the lecture, and I'm glad.
Ridiculous instrument. No, I'm sympathetic to those objections. So Pieper is pretty good at explaining that leisure is not just rest so you can work more. But that's not that complicated. We get that. It's not just taking a break so that one can work all the more. But it can feel an awful lot like an affectation of, you know, don't bother me, I'm engaged in leisure time here. So where I think Pieper is at his best, and this is why I do like In Tune with the World more than leisure. In Tune with the World, I think he explains really well that leisure goes hand in hand with contemplation. And leisure and contemplation go hand in hand with what he calls existential richness, as opposed to existential poverty. One of the marks of existential poverty is that all activity is instrumental. One does X for the sake of Y in order to actualize states of affairs Z. So we tend to think of, you know, a whole lot of servile work in this fashion, right? I do this work to get paid so that it can eat and enjoy my life. Whereas contemplation and leisure is always activity, no note, activity, right? Not a cessation of activity. Done for its own sake, or in to constitute a good worth pursuing on its for itself. So if we think of the Aristotelian distinction that we get in the opening sections of the Ethics, some goods are instrumental, which is not to say that they're not good. It's that they're goods we seek for something that they produce. And other goods are intrinsic. They're something that is sought for its own sake, and we need no other explanation for that good other than it is good to seek it. It's what we're doing the activity for. It's the point of the activity. And of course, happiness for Aristotle is an activity itself, right? It's not some accomplishment distinct from the activity. It's activity done in keeping with virtue or excellence in a complete life. So contemplation is an activity. Leisure is an activity. And it's any activity which is or can be any activity which is done for its own sake because it is good to do. And to seek that good for its own sake is a kind of contemplation. Right now, we get contemplation often wrong too, right? The image that we usually give of contemplation, which is not false, it's just that it's not exhaustive, is, you know, the statue of the thinker, chin in hand, contemplating the divine, the Platonic forms or mathematics or something. And that's contemplation too. But play is a kind of contemplation if one is doing the play for its own sake. So, you know, my kids are not little anymore, but I have an 8-year-old who this would still be true of. You'll sort of see her playing some ridiculous game, you know, made up game. What are you doing, Molly? Well, I'm playing. And if I ask her why, that question makes no sense to her. Like, how would I explain to this old man why I'm playing? I'm playing to play. And when she's playing, she is entirely lost in the play. She's not doing it for health. She's not doing it for relaxation. She's not doing it to pass the time. Maybe that's what prompted her to start the play. But when she's doing the play, she's doing it for no other reason than it is good to do. And it's a contemplative attitude. It's a kind of ecstasis. She's out of herself, absorbed in the activity. Well, that's leisure.
Yeah. Okay. I have a handful of questions, but I'm going to try to be disciplined in my order. So the first, I would say, I'm interested in the kind of interpersonal dimension of leisure, because it strikes me like, okay, when have I had experience of leisure? It's usually when other people like lay hold of me and call me out of my workaday world and say like, listen, sweetheart, this is a human life, so you should like expend yourself in human aims. And I'm like, okay. Like I think about at the House of Studies, we had like this little group of brothers who once a week would sing Irish songs. And it was great just to like learn Irish songs. And whenever we'd have the opportunity, whether on the road or back at home, we would, you know, kind of run through things that we had learned together. And I found that I spent a few years living in Switzerland. I found that like when I was hiking and I got lost or I got like cold or I got tired or I got myself in a bad spot, I would often like I would sing those songs to myself. And I don't exactly know why, you know, one never knows exactly why he does anything. But I think in part it was like the worst thing about it was my isolation. You know, I'm afraid and I'm in a bit, been a bad spot, but to be isolated is the worst of all. And so it was like I was like calling up or hearkening to that experience of a kind of communion, like a kind of shared pursuit, a human shared pursuit. So I'm like kind of working through my own little intuitions about this, but yeah, could you talk about like the interpersonal dimension of leisurely life, contemplative life, playful life?
Yeah, well, that's one of the reasons I want to insist that while, you know, the solitary thinker chin in hand, or the person in solitary prayer, that is a kind of contemplation. It's not, I'm not even sure that it's the central case of contemplation. I think it is for Aristotle. For the Christian, I'm not so sure, right? For the Christian mind, the communion that we seek, right, the final end that we seek, which we will contemplate in the beatific vision, is not only not a solitary self-contemplation, right? We're not going to be thinking about ourselves for eternity. But while, of course, we're monotheists, it's a monotheism of communion, of three persons in such perfect communion as to be one being and to have one Godhead. So it's interpersonal or relational for the Christian all the way down, because the beating heartbeat of the universe is the image of communion, because God is communion. So it's very natural, because we're created in the image of God, that our contemplation when we're looking for God is communion, is going to be interpersonal, and that we would have forms of that in our rest, in our leisure, in our play with others, right? So the Pieper, again, in tune with the world, it's a theory of festivity. I mean, it's pretty hard to feast on your own, and that seem very much like a feast. A feast seems to be the community gathered around the table. You know, the great Thanksgiving, it's proper to have at least an altar server along with the priest, yes? It's good for others to be there. It's good to hear Mass with others. It's hard to have a real dance just by oneself, one sort of swaying around, I guess. But a real dance has a partner. Or even think tradition, right? There's a kind of contemplation to tradition, but tradition is a handing on, which implies someone has it before to hand to another, and it is being handed to you by those before you. Think T.S. Eliot's lovely phrase of the wedding dance, where the wedding couple engaged in their wedding dance lives in a community where the corn is nourished by those long under the earth. I'm misquoting the poem, but nourished by those long under the earth. So it's very natural and normal for this to be intersubjective and the human thing to be a communal thing. We're not just political, right? Aristotle thinks we're political. Aquinas recognizes that we're social. And because we're social, we're political, but it's not because we're political that we're social. We are social all the way down. So yeah, leisure is going to be communal. Even in a sense, if we're hearkening back, in your example, alone, lost in the mountains, you're hearkening back to an earlier moment of communion with others. That seems to me to be fit and proper.
There was a time where I had downloaded T.S. Eliot reciting his four quartets, like one of these MP3 from YouTube downloader things, these janky converters that we used in 2015. And I like put it on my track phone because I'm living here in, you know, 2003. And like as I would jog a few times a week, I would just listen to that. That was the length of my run, you know, whatever, like 52 minutes.
Your jogging music so like, is T.S. Eliot reading the waist. Yeah. We did the four quartets.
I'm just a weird dude for one, but also like it brought about this sweet irony where I was, you know, jogging through Washington, D.C., which is a little bit of, I don't know, like a strange pluralistic apocalypse. And I'm just listening to T.S. Eliot being like a dignified and commodious sacrament.
Man and woman joined arm in arm. Yeah.
It's cool. I still have no idea what that poem is about, but I feel like that's not the point. So, okay. I want to drill down. Drill down sounds so like crass and violent, but I'd like to examine at closer quarters, this idea of like use and enjoyment. Cause maybe part of what's being suggested is like part of that's wonderful about a life together, you know, as a social and political animal, is not only that your ends cannot be met alone, you know, to live alone, you would have to be either a beast or a god, but in the sense that like it's a kind of welcome into or initiation into the life that is beyond use. You know, we use some things and we enjoy some things, and the things that we enjoy, they typically defy use. God, you know, for one, defies use. He's like, you're going to use me as like a good luck charm or like a rabbit's foot. He's like, I got other plans, sweetheart. And they involve worship. But I think that like people kind of attune us to that. Like we feel an inward sense of shame when we pick up the phone to ask a favor of a friend with whom we haven't been in contact for many months. It's like, ooh, I only asked this person to do things for me. It's like that shame it signals something, you know, like the natural law. So maybe, I don't know if you could talk just a little bit about this difference between use and enjoyment and the way in which our human communities help, you know, welcome us or initiate into it.
We are going to have to use things, right? We're moving from potency to actuality in knowledge, in our bodies, in everything. We need to use things in the world. We even need to use others for many things, right? The question is how to do so in a way which is just. But there's nothing unjust or improper per se about use. Some goods are to be used. Other goods are to be enjoyed. And it seems to me one of the difficult things that we have is to enjoy things virtuously, right? So to enjoy a good, we want to avoid either of the extremes, right? We don't want to have a deficient enjoyment, and we don't want to have an excessive enjoyment. Things which are fully good, of course, it's hard to imagine how you would excessively enjoy them. Like, what would it mean to excessively enjoy God? That's probably not so much of a danger. But when it comes to natural goods, we have to learn how to enjoy them the way they ought to be enjoyed, in keeping with their own stature. We have to learn how to enjoy them at the right time, at the right place, and the right amount, for the right reasons, and so on. And of course, we're naturally ordered towards the good, right? So the intellect has as its first object being, and the will has as its first object the good. But that's a notion. We don't know what that is yet, and we haven't appropriated it yet. And so because we're social, we have to be attuned to, habituated to, ordered to the right and just and virtuous appreciation of the goods, including how to properly enjoy them. So we're dependent upon the law. We're dependent upon education. We're dependent upon the sacraments. We're dependent upon our friends. And, you know, what we're so bereft of in our own society, and why it feels as if so many of us are adrift, is we need thick, substantial communities which train us into the proper enjoyments. Right? So think about the confusion that people have about marriage. If you live in a society in which marriage is less frequently entered into, or if marriages dissolve very quickly, the enjoyment of marriage, one has fewer examples and models and teachers of what that enjoyment should and could be than if you lived in a healthy, thriving society. So I love this line or this idea from Norris Clark, who taught at Fordham. He has this lovely little essay, Person and Communion, in which he says, we're both rich and poor. We're rich because we're created in the image of God. We're rich by our nature because we're rational animals, but we're poor because, like everything other than God, we're moving from potency to actuality. And that poverty includes real dependence on others, real dependence on grace, real dependence on nature. But we tend to think, because we want to be Stoics more than we want to be Christians often, that our poverty, our need, our dependence is a sign of inferiority or weakness, right? We really want to be little gods, self-sufficient, little islands to ourselves, kind of the Aristotelian vision of the gentleman who needs no help and promptly forgets if he's ever been given help. Clark says instead, our poverty is also a mark that we are like God, because our poverty orients us, our need for education, our need for attunement, our need for the community to instruct us, orders us to our proper end, right? Our need orders us to grace. Our need orders us to seek for God. Our need orders us to seek for friendship. And so even our poverty is a mark of divine favor given to us. I think there's something wonderful about that. And it allows ordinary human limitations, right? I don't mean by the sin, but ordinary human limitations to be open to sanctity and to be open to our great delight in those things. I need food. That's a good thing. That's a source of delight and order when properly done.
Yeah, it's interesting. I suppose I would have come to a discovery of similar things. That's a complicated way to start a sentence, Gregory. What I mean to say is I've heard something like that, and I heard it from Alistair McIntyre, yeah. Independent Rational Animal.
Yeah, that's right.
And this just like this idea is that there's a kind of facticity to our nature and our operation, and it's not to be celebrated or lamented prima facie. It's just to be like observed. It's like, well, what are we, you know? And like you said earlier, we're social and political animals. So it seems to be the case that our nature's ends are realized at least in part through sociality and politics. That is to say, through relationships, thick relationships. And then given that, we can kind of take a little deep dive into the divine wisdom and the divine will, like the divine ordination as to why it's fitting that this be the case or why it's blessed that this be the case. And then you experience it in your own life and you can, you know, kind of build on the basis of that. But I think that, yeah, just like this idea that relationship, while it involves dependence or while it involves a kind of poverty, is meant to enrich, you know, it's like meant to dignify rather than to humiliate or to otherwise suborn. I think that's really hard to understand, period. But then like for the 21st century to understand.
Well, both McIntyre and Clark add something that I think is really wonderful, which is, so McIntyre really wants to explore vulnerability, right? That we have bodies which can be wounded, independent, rational animals. At some point, we're all going to need assistance. Part of the virtuous life, an aspect of the virtuous life, is to be dependent or vulnerable or weak or in need of assistance in a way which allows or prompts others to be able to accomplish or constitute their own virtue. So, example, over the last 2-3 years, I've had 5 eye surgeries. I've had 3 detached retinas. I was blind for in my left eye for a couple of months. Some unhappy, unpleasant moments where I really needed help from my wife and children. My Molly, who's now 8, 7 at the time, would help me down the stairs because I had no depth perception and I was falling all of the time. Or there was about a week where I had to lay only on my side because the silicone bubble in your eye has to float up to the top to press against your retina. And if you turn the other way, then it pulls on the retina. So my wife would have to, you know, bring me food, sort of spoon feed me so that my head stayed on the side. Well, I think that's a kind of contemplation as well. Why was she doing this? Well, it wasn't use. She wasn't getting anything out of this, right? I wasn't paying her. She was doing it out of the excessiveness of her love for me. And I'm assuming she probably needed some state of grace of the marital state as well to deal with me here. But she became more gentle, more kind, more generous, because I was in the condition of needing her to be generous. Now, I think that's a kind of contemplation and leisure as well, right? Back to, this is not an affectation of, oh, I'm a man of leisure. Insofar as she was caring for me because I was her spouse and she loved me for my own sake, that's leisure. That's an activity done for its own sake, prompted by love, where my need allows her to be contemplative and to have leisure. even though you wouldn't describe, you know, spoon feeding your husband as he's ill in bed in the usual model of leisure. It wasn't restful.
Yeah.
It was rich.
Yeah. Like I want to think, so this point that you make about vulnerability, I was reading recently about, you know, like risk, just reading something written, I think it was by Pope Benedict XVI, that there's a kind of risk to every relationship insofar as it entails a certain vulnerability, and one will only ever be enriched by a relationship, be saved by a relationship to the degree or extent that he makes himself vulnerable to it. So I'm thinking especially like, you know, you could say that of angels, but it wouldn't make as much sense. I think you say that of human beings in part because of our embodiedness, and I think it makes sense in that setting, makes more sense in that setting. So I'm thinking this, like, you know, we're having a conversation about play or about leisure. Like, what role does play or leisure play in, that word can be used in various senses. What role does leisure play in, I don't know if the word that I want to use is like helping us to be vulnerable or like almost softening the starkness of our vulnerability or like what's exactly going on there? Because I feel like if I can entrust myself to play, I can entrust myself to the other with like a better sense or a fuller sense of abandon. I don't know what I'm trying to say. Help me.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, you know, when we chatted earlier, you sent me the email that we're going to do this. You mentioned eutropelia. Right, which is kind of playfulness, but especially playfulness with words, a kind of wittiness. In Aristotle, in Book 4 of the Ethics, it's the mean between boorishness and buffoonery, right? Buffoonery will do anything to get a laugh, no matter how injurious or indecent. And the boor laughs at nothing, sees nothing that's witty. Aquinas, in his commentary on that, and then in the second part of the Summa, when he's talking about this, he doesn't seem to suggest that playfulness is done for its own sake. It does not appear to be leisure. It seems to be something of use. So in the Summa, when he's articulating this, it's the body gets weary, and so we need to rest the body. And the mind or the soul gets weary. He talks about a weariness of soul when we've been doing intellectual labors or intellectual activities, and we get tired of soul. Now, he seems to be more than just the sort of, oh, I'm tired, I've been thinking a long time, I need to sort of, you know, stretch my legs, get a cup of coffee, and take a mental break. I think he means weariness of soul, a kind of exhaustion that the bow has been bent for too long, and the bow will break if there's not a relaxation. And so wittiness, a kind of playfulness with words, which is directed by reason towards the mean between buffoonery and boorishness, but which also recognizes time and place, which recognizes the person, you know, the one doing this matters. It really seems to be of use, though. It seems to be an instrument of rest as opposed to something that's sought for its own sake. It's enjoyable, but it's useful in its enjoyment. It's here so as to give us respite. So if I'm reading him correctly, that does not seem to be in his mind leisure. All right. Well, it seems I wonder if we could think of play, though, as moving towards leisure when we seek the play out of an excess or an abundance of love. So there's a sense in which we can be playful to as a sort of use to rest our soul so as to be able to get back in the saddle. But I think there's another form of playfulness which is not done merely for our own rest, but to bring joy to another. Like, it's very clear that he thinks of this as sociable, because it's always placed in the context of, are you injuring someone, right? To rail against another is different than to, in a sense, jest with them to bring them enjoyment and rest. If out of an excess of love, I am witty and pleasant for another to bring them delight, that seems to me to be in the same ballpark of leisure, because I'm doing that for its own sake. I'm doing that out of love for the other. I'm doing that for the good of the other. Now, clearly, it's a sort of means by which I do that, but the means seems to be partially constitutive of the good that I'm seeking. It's not as if I'm trying to be witty so as to make you laugh, so as to make you happy. I'm trying to be witty, which in part constitutes the pleasantness of the exchange, which in this small way is the good of the moment. I think we can get playfulness or wittiness in the ballpark of leisure if we add love to it. If we are being witty, pleasant for the good of the other, out of an excessiveness of concern for the other. Excessiveness here, I don't mean, you know, an extreme. I mean, out of myself, I have an excess of goodness, which can, the good seeks to communicate itself as far as possible. So my good is able to be excessive, go beyond me to include you. Boy, I think we're in the ballpark of leisure there. Mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Like, let's talk about, maybe this is a final thought. Talk about a snow day, the kind of phenomenology of a snow day.
Best day.
Because, well, yeah, right. Well, when I was like 9 years old, you heard snow day and you're like, cool. I'm going to put Hershey's syrup on a bunch of snow and then eat it. I'm going to go sledding with all of my friends and then come home and my mom is going to have tomato soup and grilled cheese for me. And then I'm going to go outside and I'm going to make a fort and then I'm going to have a snowball fight. And then I'm probably going to come home and have dinner and then we're going to pray the family rosary. And then I'm going to go to sleep and it's going to be awesome.
And it's going to last forever.
Exactly. It's going to be this like sweet, timeless repose of frenzied activity. But then like round about the time that I turned like 15 or 16, it became complicated because I was like, oh no, I have a workout to run. In fact, two-a-days. So I'm going to have to like go to the gym and jog on the treadmill inside because the roads are dangerous, but hopefully they'll have the track to thaw because I'm supposed to do repeat thousands this afternoon. And also this is a sweet opportunity to get out ahead of that geometry project that I have been dilatory in my preparation for. So I'm just going to like treat this like a work day, but just like a turbo work day without any classes. And so I think like when you describe play as tending unto leisure, I'm just thinking of my experience of like my relationship to time, my relationship to opportunity, my relationship to like windfall, you know, or like kind of unforeseen or surprising changes in life. Yeah, maybe as like a final note, could you just like talk a little bit about our relation? Like, I don't know, any part of that you want to comment on in our relationship to the world and its marvels.
Pieper has another little essay. I can't think of what book it is, but Only the Lover Sings. Mm. Right, only the lover sings, or he says in an attunement, the eyes of love see best. Right, those with the eyes of love see most clearly. So, this just goes back again to existential poverty and existential richness. When we're existentially poor, we're always counting costs. We expend effort in expectation of return. We expend time in expectation of return. In contemplation, there is no expectation of return. You're doing it for itself, for its own sake. So, you know, the cares of the world are many. And, you know, you're at 15, you're not 8. And at 45, one is not 15. There are bills to pay and pursuits to be accomplished and futures to be planned for and so on. Right? We're not asked to be irresponsible. We're not asked to avoid our work. The creation mandates given to Adam and Eve include tending and filling the garden. They're here to work. And our Lord was a carpenter. He worked. He worked. He also prayed. He also had friends. He went, took time alone in solitude, but he worked. Paul was a tent maker. There's nothing unseemly about work. So it seems to me that one of the tasks here is even when the cares of the world become many, bills to pay, two-a-days to do, a geometry project that you need to get ahead on, the lover still sings. And the one who has eyes of love sees most clearly. So when we look at the work, I'm thinking here of John Paul II from his encyclical on work from Laborum Exercens. When we think only of the objective dimension of work, we're always looking at the product. When we look at the subjective dimension of work, we include the worker, who's the person. And I'm always at stake in my work. Every work that I do in part constitutes my character. If I can do my work with the eyes of love, yeah, it's work in the sense of it's bringing about external products. It might not be work that I would do for its own sake. I'm doing the geometry project to get the grades so that I can pass the class and get a job or what have you. There still is a contemplative disposition or the eyes of love that we can be forming and practicing in ourselves, even when we're doing the work, which is not something we would do for its own sake. Right? So the smallest details of work done from great love and done of love of God is at least a contemplative disposition, even if it's not contemplation at the particular moment, because it's instrumental in use. Right? We can always be forming the subjective disposition in ourselves to be ready and well-disposed for a feast to break out at any moment, because we're already looking for it at all times, even when we're just head down to the grindstone, nose to the grindstone, doing the task in front of us, which is arduous and difficult. We're ready to love the work because we're ready to love the virtue which the work allows. And we're ready to love the gift of self, which our work is always an offer to the world, right? Because we're doing something for the world. And if we have a supernatural point of view, is always being offered potentially, if we want to God, which is to be contemplatives in the middle of the world.
Yeah. Have you seen the movie About Time?
Doesn't ring a bell.
Okay, it's by the same studio that made like Notting Hill and other British romantic comedies. And so
I've never
somebody
seen
recommended
those.
It to me, and they're like, you should watch this. Yeah, they're like, you should watch this. I was like, I mean, do I have to? And they're like, it's awesome. I think you might actually enjoy this movie. The conceit is that the men of this family can travel in time. The question is, what will they use their time travel power to accomplish? And the choice in this one man's case, the protagonist, is love. And so you see like his attempt to revise his life that it be more lovely, not like crassly or indulgently, but in a genuine way. And it's actually quite moving, but he comes basically to the conclusion that you just enunciated. Like he in time becomes a contemplative, and it doesn't ruin anything, but like he never, by the time he arrives at the end of his life, he's not traveling back in time, because he has the disposition of one who receives each new day as the gift that it in fact is. And he doesn't have to revisit it in order to appreciate that, because he just kind of sees clearly that it is. It's awesome.
He's in a sense living with an eye to eternity, even though time bound. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not a huge fan of Kierkegaard. I find him frustrating, but there is a lovely depiction of Kierkegaard gives of the Knight of Faith. And the Knight of Faith looks like every other person in the town. He has his plans. He's thinking about his dinner. He gets home. His wife doesn't have the dinner that he hoped for, and it doesn't bother him at all, because he has a kind of purity of heart, right? He is always approaching things from the disposition of faith, and to have the disposition of faith is to be ready to love anyway. And so everything, in a sense, is fully present for him and ready to go. You know, it's funny, our society. You know, you look at the pages of Psychology Today, or you go to Barnes & Noble to the philosophy section, which is just the self-help section now. You know, the term mindfulness is everywhere in that literature. Well, I think what they're trying to find in their own way is a disposition to eternity, or an eye to the fullness of God, which is in part we're given a foreshadow of even now, because all things participate in God, and God bestows existence on all things. God's nearer to us than we are to ourselves. All that is sustained and preserved in existence by God's gift of existence just now and just now to that thing. The fullness of God is ready to hand.
Boom. I think that's a beautiful note on which to conclude. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks
for taking the time,
Father Gregory.
Yeah. If folks want to follow up with you or with the work of the Witherspoon Institute, where might they do so?
You can go to www.winst.org, or to the Public Discourse, which is the journal that we edit. Those would be good places to go.
Wonderful. All right. Well, God's continued blessing on you, your family, on your work. And yeah, thanks again.
Thanks so much.
All right, turning to you, the listener, thanks for tuning into this episode of the Thomistic Institute podcast. Be sure to like and subscribe if that is of service to you in your ongoing formation. If it is not, then don't. And know of our prayers for you. We'll ask that you pray for us, and we'll look forward to chatting with you next time on the Thomistic Institute podcast.